of empathy, it's a call to courage, and a path toward wisdom. Like all emotions, regret can be used constructively or destructively, but the wholesale dismissal of regret is wrong-headed and dangerous. That saying, no regrets, doesn't mean living with courage. It means living without reflection. To live without regret is to believe you have nothing to learn, no amends to make, and no opportunity to be braver with your life. A friend of mine who knew I was studying regret in my data sent me a picture of a tough-looking kid who had a tattoo that read, no regrets, but regrets was spelled R-A-G-R-E-T-S, and it was tattooed across his chest. I later found out that the image was from the film We're the Millers. It's such a perfect metaphor for what I've learned. If you have no regrets, or you intentionally set out to live without regrets, I think you're missing the very value of regret. One of the truest things I've ever heard about regret came from George Saunders' 2013 commencement address at Syracuse University. He talked about how when he was a child, a young girl was teased at his school, and although he didn't tease her, and he even defended her a little, he still thought about it. He said, "So here's something I know to be true, although it's a little corny, and I don't quite know what to do with it. What I regret most in my life are failures of kindness. Those moments when another human being was there, in front of me, suffering, and I responded sensibly, reservedly, mildly." During a research focus group at West Point, I asked a group of officers, many of whom had lost troop members during combat, about the word regret and how it fit into their combat experiences. One officer said, "I wouldn't say regret. It's different. I have profound grief about the losses. I made all of the calls to the parents myself. I would trade places with any of my soldiers in a minute if I could, but I can't. And I've been over it 1,000 times. I believe I was doing the best I could with the intelligence we had. Do I wish there was a different outcome? Every minute of the day." Wondering if maybe he subscribed to the no-regret school of thought, I asked if he had any regrets at all. He responded with a story remarkably similar to the one Saunders included in his speech. He said, "Yes, when I was in high school, there was a girl who was different. She had special needs, and every now and then she would eat lunch in the cafeteria with us. She had a crush on me, and my friends gave me a hard time about it. When she asked to sit with me once, I told her she couldn't. I deeply regret that. I could have done something different at that moment, and I didn't. I deeply regret it." I believe that what we regret most are our failures of courage, whether it's the courage to be kinder, to show up, to say how we feel, to set boundaries, or to be good to ourselves. For that reason, regret can be the birthplace of empathy. When I think of the times when I wasn't being kind or generous, when I chose being liked over defending someone or something that deserved defending, I feel deep regret. But I've also learned something. Regret is what taught me that living outside of my values is not tenable for me. Regrets about not taking chances have made me braver. Regrets about shaming or blaming people I care about have made me more thoughtful. Sometimes the most uncomfortable learning is the most powerful. The revolution. In the introduction, I wrote, "People who wade into discomfort and vulnerability and tell the truth about their stories are the real badasses." I think this is why I appreciate Andrew's story so much. In my book, he's a total badass. Here's a person who didn't have to own anything, a leader who could have shifted the blame to his own team or to the brand's disrespectful team. But instead, he had the courage to feel pain, to recognize that he was feeling shame, to reach out and be vulnerable with a friend, to own his part, and to stand in front of his team and be accountable. The delta between "I am a screw-up" and "I screwed up" may look small, but in fact, it's huge. Many of us will spend our entire lives trying to slog through the shame swampland to get to a place where we can give ourselves permission to both be imperfect and to believe that we are enough. While composting may be a terrible fate for a book, it's a powerful metaphor for failure. Having the courage to own our mistakes, screw-ups, and failures, and to embed the key learnings from these rumbles into our lives, our families, and our organizations yields the exact same results as adding nutrient-rich humus to soil. It brings growth and new vitality. In her book, The Rise, Sarah Lewis writes, "The word failure is imperfect. Once we begin to transform it, it ceases to be that any longer. The term is always slipping off the edges of our vision, not simply because it's hard to see without wincing, but because once we are ready to talk about it, we often call the event something else, a learning experience, a trial, a reinvention, no longer the static concept of failure. Failure can become nourishment if we are willing to get curious, show up vulnerable and human, and put rising strong into practice. We can't be brave in the big world without at least one small safe space to work through our fears and falls. Chapter 10. You gotta dance with them that brung you. Rumbling with shame, identity, criticism, and nostalgia. I had a visceral reaction when Andrew compared shame to being under a rock. I knew exactly what he was talking about when he described the folly of trying to make decisions while in that impossibly dark, heavy, suffocating place. When we experience shame, we are hijacked by the limbic part of our brain that limits our options to flight, fight, or freeze. Those survival responses rarely leave room for thought, which is why most of us desperately shift around under the rock, looking for reflexive relief by hiding, blaming, or lashing out, or by people-pleasing. I was also inspired by Andrew's willingness to do the bruising work of getting out from under the rock before he took action. That not only requires self-awareness and a strong reckoning with emotion, but also being ready and willing to rumble, even when, like Andrew, we recognize that climbing out will leave us more exposed and ultimately require more courage. Most of us have developed ways of offloading or numbing the pain. So when Andrew and I reconnected so he could review his story for this book, I told him that I was in awe of his awareness. He attributed it to learning about shame and being able to recognize when he's in it. His rock analogy also reminded me of two things. The first was the description of Act 2 that Darla, the producer from Pixar, shared with me. The protagonist looks for every comfortable way to solve the problem. By the climax, he learns what it's really going to take to solve the problem. This act includes the lowest of the low. The second was a particular time in my life when I was trying to operate from a place of shame. It's the perfect cautionary tale about the dangers of under-the-rock decision-making. I want to share it with you for several reasons. The first is that although we can't go back and change history, we can benefit from thinking about some of our past falls and viewing them through the lens of the Rising Strong process. In this case, I was able to look back and see exactly where shame and fear ran roughshod over my curiosity. This story also illustrates how writing can be an extremely powerful tool for uncovering the story we're making up. When I'm in the whirlwind of high emotion, writing my SFD in the form of a letter, or even fantasizing about what I'd like to say to someone, can help me get clear on the story I'm making up. As I mentioned in Chapter 3, Owning Our Stories, the value of writing and storytelling came up in the research, but it wasn't until I thought about this particular story that I connected it to myself. It's nice to know there's some constructive use for all those conversations and revenge schemes I rehearse in my head when I'm lying in bed at night. This story is a great reminder of the power of engaging with a therapist or coach, or being part of a support group that gives us the space to explore our emotions and experiences without judgment. My therapist, Diana, retired at the end of our work together. I know, don't say it. Since then, I've had a hard time finding a safe place to do this work. I worked with a leadership coach concerning a very specific work crisis, and that was invaluable. But in writing this story for the book, I've realized that I could use some more consistent support. I believe we all need that. It's unfair to ask our partners to hold space for the thrashing about that is a necessary part of the reckoning and the rumble, especially when they're part of the story. The same is true for our colleagues. Over the past 2 years, I've been surprised and heartened by the number of leaders I've encountered who either work closely with a therapist or coach, or are part of a small group of other leaders who meet specifically to support each other in working through tough emotional issues. I'm reminded in particular of a group of 8 Dallas CEOs who invited me to join them last year for one of their regular support gatherings. For years, this group has come together to share and work through the exact kind of issues I'm talking about in this book. What it takes to be authentic, to be all in, and to fall and get back up. In fact, each of the members had written his story using Joseph Campbell's Hero's Journey as a framework. The evening I met with them, several of the men shared their journeys. It was transformative. The stories were full of courage, heartbreak, wild success, and devastating personal and professional failures. With that group, they had created what I call a safe container, a place where people can share experiences honestly, knowing that what they share will be respected and kept in confidence. The story I'm about to tell reminded me of why we all need this kind of support. We can't be brave in the big world without at least one small safe space to work through our fears and falls. Long vowels and short fuses. Part of my email sorting process is to review the sender and subject lines of each message before opening it. Blindly clicking on emails is like opening the front door without looking through the peephole. It can be dangerous. On this particular day several years ago, one name sent up a flare as I scrolled down the list, though at first I couldn't quite put my finger on why. I read the name over and over as I tried to match it with the places and groups that make up my life. The university, the church, the kids' school, the neighborhood, speaking events? Nothing. I pushed my chair back a little and read the name out loud. When it finally came to me, I rolled my eyes so hard, I'm surprised they're not still lodged in the back of my head. The email was from a woman whom we'll call Pamela. It has the same number of syllables as her actual name, which is important for no real reason, except that even the way she said her name bugged me. Pamela. As if I were 2 years old and I was just learning how to use my words. I had met Pamela several weeks earlier, after a talk I gave at a fundraising event and luncheon. I first saw her when I was standing in the lunch buffet line right after the lecture. I have pretty set boundaries for eating at my speaking events. I don't eat in public before I speak. This means that if I'm invited to speak at a luncheon, I'm going to eat before I arrive and just drink water while I'm waiting to be introduced. I'm too nervous to eat, and there's no good way to pick pepper out of your teeth when you're sitting at a table next to the stage, surrounded by hundreds of people watching you. I also don't like to eat after events very often because I'm extremely introverted. People who don't know me always assume that I'm an extrovert, while the people who do know me would describe my severe introversion as one of my defining characteristics. Being on stage is comfortable for me because it's my work. But put me in the middle of a cocktail party, and you'll find me with a frozen smile, wishing I could curl up under a table in the fetal position. On this particular day, I was joining a small group of college students for a 30-minute lunch after I spoke. This seemed completely doable. I love talking to students. It feels like home to me. As I stood in the buffet line, I spotted Pamela right away. I wasn't sure what she was telling the people who stood between us, but I could see that she was picking them off one by one, moving ever closer to me. Finally, when there were only two people left standing between us, I heard her tell the woman behind me, I'm sorry, excuse me, I need to talk to Dr. Brown about event issues. When I finally turned around, she was literally 6 inches away. With some awkward squeezing, she drew her wrist up against her chest and stuck out her hand for a quick introduction handshake. I backed up as much as I could, but there was still only about a foot between us. I raised my eyebrows in a kind of greeting and said, "Hello, I'm Brené. Nice to meet you." There was no way in hell I was going to attempt a handshake in the minuscule space between us. By this time, we were about 3 people away from the food. I turned around so we were both facing forward and spoke to her over my shoulder. "So, are you on the event team?" Everything turned out really well. "Oh no," she replied. "I'm here representing a large chain of organizations. I want to talk to you about the possibility of doing some events for us. I attend events like a scout, looking for talented speakers." I was a little annoyed at her subterfuge, but I managed to stay civil. In the 3 minutes it took us to make our way from the silverware, past the chicken salad, and to the cans of soda at the end of the table, I learned these 3 things from Pamela. 1, she hates where she works because her bosses are always telling her that her job would be the very first to go if there was ever downsizing. 2, she isn't really trained in mental health, but she's seen so many presentations that she could do it better than most of the people who are doing it for a living. And 3, her dream is eventually to stop scouting for speakers and become a speaker herself. As we walked away from the buffet, plates and drinks in hand, I turned to her and said, "Well, it was nice to meet you," then kept walking. I sat down at a table that was reserved for our group. It was empty, except for purses and event programs that students had left to save their spaces. I purposely sat down in an unsafe seat, sandwiched between 2 safe seats, so I could give those students my attention. Following resolutely behind me, Pamela set her plate down next to my plate and moved someone's jacket and event program to free the seat. Before I could say anything, she was beside me. I watched her eyes grow small and her jaw tighten. My bosses send me around to find good speakers. I could speak circles around most people. Of course, I can't tell them that. They want credentialed people. Like a list of letters behind your name makes you a good speaker. But I can't even challenge them because they'll remind me that I'm expendable. I'm tempted to tell them that I can't find any decent speakers and offer my services. They're too stupid and concerned about money to recognize the talent that's right in front of them. By now, the students had returned to the table. The student whose belongings had been moved looked confused for a second and then sat down. Pamela practically leaped out of her seat upon their arrival. Taking in the table, she squealed, "Look, look, we get to have lunch with a speaker. Isn't she just fabulous? She's just precious." Listening to her, I still sensed the bitterness and fear in her words. She was working hard to fake excitement for the newcomers, but I wondered how long she could keep that anger and resentment at bay. I wasn't sure why she was so angry, but it was clear that she was. I stayed for 30 minutes, trying to keep focused on the students, before I rose from my seat. The students looked at me with understanding and a little bit of nervous desperation at being left with this woman. Pamela stared up at me with barely cloaked contempt. It would have been so easy to say, "Thanks for ruining my lunch, you nut job," but that would have been bad manners. I just said, "Please excuse me, I need to pack for my flight." The memories of meeting Pamela were enough to convince me to wait a while before opening her email. I read a few other emails, made myself a cup of coffee, sat back down at my computer, and clicked. She wrote, "Dr. Brown, I have told my boss, Cheryl, that I highly recommend you based on the fact that most conference attendees seem to enjoy your presentation. You will probably hear from her in the next couple of weeks. Just a bit of friendly feedback. If you're going to position yourself as an expert and a scholar in your area, I think it's important that you pronounce your colleagues' names correctly. When you quoted Pema Chodron, you said Pema Chodron. The correct pronunciation is Pema Chodron. Sincerely, Pamela." The words were perfectly clear on the computer screen, but in my head, they started to dance around, getting all jumbled up with my fear. Had I made a fool of myself? Her intent linked up with my shame and made it impossible for me to keep it all straight. Within a matter of seconds, I had turned, "If you're going to position yourself as an expert and scholar," into "Stop pretending that you're an expert and scholar." I felt like a scared middle schooler. I found myself completely hijacked by that moment. A moment that I have described to tens of thousands of people. I wrote the book on that moment, literally. It is the moment when shame crashes over you with such force that you go into do-or-die survival mode. Ironically, I always warn people, especially mental health professionals, not to be seduced into believing that they can manage these moments simply because they've learned how they work. We call shame the master emotion for a reason. Had I been able to whisper in my own ear as I sat there staring at this email and fighting off the pain of feeling like an exposed imposter, I would have told myself, "This is the moment, Brené. Don't do anything. Don't say anything. Just breathe and feel your way through it. Don't hide out. Don't suck up. Don't fight back. Don't talk, type, or make contact with anyone until you get back on your emotional feet. You will be okay." Unfortunately, I couldn't whisper those assurances to myself. Mispronouncing Pema Chodron's name had hit all of my shame triggers related to never being good enough. Rather than sounding like a refined academic, I imagined that I had sounded just like Minnie Pearl on Hee Haw. "Howdy! Let's give a warm little welcome to our little Buddhist friend, Sister Pema Chodron." Cue the banjos. My heart raced and rage coursed through my veins with such force that my entire body was shaking. I sat rigid in my chair. My eyes were ablaze. The heat was unbearable, and I became convinced that sitting still for too long would result in Houston's first case of spontaneous human combustion. I finally pounded my fist on the computer table. "Oh, that pinch-faced, passive-aggressive shithead," I yelled. I pulled in as much air as I could get through my nose and pushed it out of my mouth. Again and again. A cool calm returned to my body. Not the kinder, gentler type of calm that I teach people about, but the kind of calm that comes before calculated cruelty. I shut down my email program and opened up Microsoft Word. I would craft my response in Word first, so I could make sure there were no spelling or grammatical errors. Nothing dulls the edge of an otherwise lethal weapon like a there, T-H-E-I-R, that should have been a there, T-H-E-R-E, or an effect that should have been an affect. I opened up a new document, and, just like Charlie Daniels sings in The Devil Went Down to Georgia, fire flew from my fingertips. The devil opened up his case and he said, "I'll start the show, and fire flew from his fingertips as he rosined up his bow. Then he pulled the bow across the strings, and it made an evil hiss. And a band of demons joined in, and it sounded something like this. With every keystroke, I felt better. I wrote and edited and wrote and edited. When I was done, I copied the letter and pasted it into an email addressed to Pamela. Just 1 millisecond before I hit send, I panicked. I was flooded with uncertainty. It's hard to fight fire with fire without backup. I needed support and a tiny smidgen of approval. In addition to perfecting and performing, I'm an expert pollster. When in doubt, survey. So in call after call to friends, I explained the situation and asked for advice. After 5 calls, it was unanimous. Number 1, she was indeed a pinch-faced, passive-aggressive wannabe shithead. And 2, I should not send the email. 2 of my friends thought it wasn't worth it because it would jeopardize my chance of speaking for this large national organization. 1 friend told me that she avoided conflict at all cost and advised the same for me. And my other 2 friends thought it was just a bad use of my time and energy. I still wasn't sure. My email response was magnificent. It's hard to let go of that kind of craftsmanship. Plus, I had the opportunity to hurt someone who had hurt me. Those opportunities don't come around every day. I finally printed copies of Pamela's email and my email and stuck them both in my purse. I had an appointment with Diana the next day. She could help me decide. I plopped down on Diana's sofa, pulled out the emails, and said, "Okay, I need your help. I'm going crazy." We both chuckled. Then I clarified, "No, really, I have a specific crazy thing, not a general going crazy thing." I set the whole thing up for Diana. I told her about how Pamela had cut the line, the lunch, everything. Then I read the email from Pamela aloud. Diana grimaced. I acknowledged her frown by saying, "Pretty shitty, right?" Diana said, "Yes, totally shitty." I told her that I thought Pamela was a pinch-faced, passive-aggressive shithead, and that all my friends thought so too. Diana hit me back with a look that said, "Not interested in your survey results, Brené." Diana wasn't too supportive of my living my life according to the polls. "Okay, well, anyway, are you ready for my response?" Diana said, "Ready." I unfolded my reply and read it to her. "Dear Pamela, I received your email regarding future event collaborations. I'm copying Cheryl, your boss, on this email as it pertains to both of you. I have some serious concerns about working with your organization. During our lunch in Miami, you told me that your bosses are stupid and only concerned about money. I'm not sure if this is an accurate representation of your organizational environment or was merely an inappropriate expression of your frustration regarding your current work situation. Either way, I found these comments to be very unprofessional, especially coming from someone who was publicly representing such a well-respected organization. Secondly, I understand your desire to become a speaker. However, I was alarmed when you mentioned that you're considering telling your superiors that you were unable to find a suitable speaker in the hopes that they would invite you to speak. While I agree with your statement that credentials are not a prerequisite for being an effective speaker, I do hope you understand the credentialing requirements of lectures done for continuing education and training. Regardless of your talents, to position yourself as a mental health professional would have serious ethical implications for your organization. Again, I appreciate your recommendation to Cheryl. However, before I can commit to speaking on behalf of your organization, I'll need some clarification regarding the concerns outlined in this email. Best, Brené Brown, PhD, LMSW. I was pleased as punch. I felt as if I had doubled in size as I read that letter. I felt all proud and puffy, like a third grader reading a teacher's commendation to her mother. Diana said, "Wow, you CC'd her boss. Going for total annihilation, huh?" I smiled. "Like my dad says, you mess with the bull, you get the horns." Diana was still for a moment, then responded, "So, Tell me, when you picture Pamela reading this email, what is she feeling? How do you want her to feel when she reads this, knowing that her boss has a copy of it? Creasing the printouts in my hand, I wondered where to start. I'm sure, on an unconscious level, I knew how I wanted her to feel. I'm sure it's what drove me. I thought about it for a minute, then told Diana, I want her to feel small. I want her to feel found out. I want her to feel scared, like she's been caught. I want her to squirm. A wave of heat made its way up from my chest until my entire face felt as if it were melting. This time, it wasn't the fire of rage. It was the slow burn of truth. A terrible silence filled the air, and the room started to do what it always does whenever a painful insight is washing over me. It became unbearably stuffy. I felt unbearably small. To make matters worse, Diana started doing the weird face thing that she always did when she had to sit silently while truth washed over me. Her eyes winced, she pursed her mouth a little bit, and she took on the look of a mother watching her infant get a shot. I knew the look. I had worn it many times, as a mother, a teacher, and a social worker. Her face said, I don't like this either, but it's why we're here. Just hang on. I can't stop the hurt, but I'm right here to help you feel your way through it. I set my printouts down on the couch. Then I kicked off my flip-flops, pulled my knees up to my chest, wrapped my arms around my legs, and rested my forehead on my knees. I sat very still. Oh, God. I cannot believe this. This is terrible. I slowly repeated what I had just said. I wanted to feel small and stupid and found out. I wanted to feel ashamed and afraid and not good enough. I wanted to feel like an imposter who's been caught. Diana still said nothing. A kind, non-judgmental, nurturing nothing. She had a way of helping me believe in normal crazy. Like, however crazy we may be, we're all the same, and the only danger of normal crazy is not knowing what you're doing and why you're doing it. I never felt ashamed with her, ever. I didn't lift my head when I said, this makes perfect sense, but I hate it. This is such bullshit. Diana always knew exactly what to say. Nothing. My forehead still resting on my knees, I realized that I needed to say it out loud. A decade of studying shame had taught me the value of doing the one thing that felt the scariest and most counterintuitive. I had to speak shame. I had to say this out loud. I have such shame about mispronouncing words and things like that. I feel stupid and small and found out. And ashamed, and afraid, and like an imposter, and like someone who got caught pretending to be smart. There was just a whole bunch more quiet after that. Of course I wanted Pamela to feel like an imposter who had been exposed. That's exactly how I felt. I'll never write enough books or earn enough degrees to meet the standard I set up for smart, the New Yorker smart, the Ivy League smart. That anywhere but where I'm from, smart. No credentials or letters behind my name can change the fact that I'm a fifth-generation Texan with imperfect grammar, the tendency to cuss too much when I'm tired or fired up, and an ongoing struggle to police my long vowels and colloquialisms. As I sat there in the uncomfortable silence, the first visual that crept into my mind was that dreadful scene in The Silence of the Lambs, when Hannibal Lecter exposes Jodie Foster's character, FBI agent Clarice Starling. You're so ambitious, aren't you? You know what you look like to me? With your good bag and your cheap shoes? You look like a rube. A well-scrubbed, hustling rube with a little taste. Good nutrition's given you some length of bone, but you're not more than one generation from poor white trash, are you, Agent Starling? And that accent you've tried so desperately to shed? Pure West Virginia. What does your father do? Is he a coal miner? Does he stink of the lamp? I wanted Diana to say something, to make it better. I wanted her to chase down Hannibal Lecter and all of my gremlins and make them go away. But she would never jump in and interfere with the critically important process of my actually feeling something. My work with her was about letting all of the hard-fought knowledge that I kept stored up in my head seep down into my very protected heart. I needed space to let that happen, and if there's one thing Diana could do, it was hold space. She could hold the space I needed to feel. She could hold whatever space I needed to cuss and thrash around and hate people. She could hold the space I needed to be exhausted and imperfect and angry. She is an extraordinary space holder. When I finally put my feet on the floor and looked up, I said, "This is painful. So much worse than pissed off. So much more painful than anger." Diana said, "Yes, this is harder than pissed off." Then we were quiet for another long stretch of time. Finally, I looked at her and said, "So is writing a pissed off letter a pretty reliable tool? If you figure out how you want someone to feel, can you always use that to understand how you're feeling?" By this point in our relationship, Diana was keenly aware of my love of formulas and tools. She said, "Every situation is different, but I think it could be a very helpful way for you to explore what you're feeling, especially when you're in your mess with the bull mode." The Reckoning. I'm pretty sure that having fire flying from my fingertips and fearing spontaneous combustion are solid physiological markers of emotion. My first face down in the arena moment in this story happened when I read Pamela's email. However, not having a rising strong practice back then, I chose getting even over getting curious. My second face down moment happened on Diana's couch, when I realized that my letter was a hurtful attempt to shift shame from myself to Pamela. Mercifully, with Diana's help, I chose curiosity this time. To be honest, choosing curiosity when I'm in shame is something that I'll need to stay mindful of for the rest of my life. I shared the story with my dad and told him that we needed to come up with a new bull saying. Thank your lucky stars you weren't on that call. I get my predilection for metaphors from him, and we spent 30 minutes talking about bulls tearing through emotional china shops and staying atop shame bulls for 8 seconds to qualify for the rodeo. We finally gave up on trying to be clever in favor of something straightforward. I said, "How about when you mess with the bull's going into timeout for 30 minutes? My dad's response tells you everything you need to know about us. He said, "Well, sis, it doesn't quite have the ring or the gravitas, but if you can wrestle that bull into the barn while you sort out your emotions, you'll save yourself some serious heartache." The Rumble. To get to the Delta and the key learnings, I had to rumble with shame, identity, criticism, and nostalgia. One reason for this is the complexity of shame resilience. In my earlier books, I talk about the four elements of shame resilience that had emerged in my research. Men and women with high levels of shame resilience share these four things in common. One, they understand and recognize what messages and expectations trigger shame for them. Two, they practice critical awareness by reality checking the messages and expectations that tell us that being imperfect means being inadequate. Three, they reach out and share their stories with people they trust. And four, they speak shame. They use the word shame. They talk about how they're feeling, and they ask for what they need. In the process of reality checking the messages that fuel shame, we often have to dig into identity, labels, and stereotypes. We also have to explore whether the expectations are rooted, as they often are, in nostalgia, or the perilous practice of comparing a current struggle with an edited version of the way things used to be. Rumbling with identity. I dearly love the state of Texas, but I consider that a harmless perversion on my part and discuss it only with consenting adults. Molly Ivins. Integration is the soul of rising strong. We have to be whole to be wholehearted. To embrace and love who we are, we have to reclaim and reconnect with the parts of ourselves we've orphaned over the years. We have to call back home all of those parts of ourselves that we have abandoned. Carl Jung called this individuation. In his book, Finding Meaning in the Second Half of Life, Jungian analyst James Hollis writes, "Perhaps Jung's most compelling contribution is the idea of individuation, that is, the lifelong project of becoming more nearly the whole person we're meant to be. What the gods intended, not the parents or the tribe, or especially the easily intimidated or the inflated ego. While revering the mystery of others, our individuation summons each of us to stand in the presence of our own mystery and become more fully responsible for who we are in this journey we call our life." One of the greatest challenges of becoming myself has been acknowledging that I'm not who I thought I was supposed to be, or who I always pictured myself being. From the time I was in 9th grade, I wanted out of my Texan identity. I wanted to be just like Annie Hall. I dreamed of the day I could be a sophisticated New York intellectual with a loft in Soho and a weekly appointment with an expensive analyst. I wanted to be erudite, stylish, and fashionably complicated. Well, as it turns out, I've got more in common with Annie Oakley than I do with Annie Hall. I'm a cusser from a long maternal line of cussers. I call the refrigerator the icebox and the countertops drain boards. I grew up hunting deer and shooting skeet. And I don't understand why everyone doesn't use the words tump, fixin', and y'all. They're so efficient. Why waste time saying turn and dump when you can just say, "Hey, kids, be careful. Y'all are fixing to tump those glasses over." Plus, y'all is much more gender-friendly than you guys. And as Pamela pointed out, I can run my vowels long and hard. I once received an email asking me to reconsider my violent animal sayings. Given my total squeamishness and low tolerance for violence, I was shocked. However, while sharing a parenting story with a large audience, I apparently said something like, "I couldn't get the kids dressed, and I was running around the house like a chicken with its head cut off. Finally, when Charlie wouldn't raise his hands up so I could slip on his shirt, I said, 'Skin a rabbit right this minute. We're late for school. I mean business.'" I'll admit this sounds pretty gross, but honestly, you don't even notice it when you're raised hearing this stuff. It's not as if you're actually envisioning a skinned rabbit or a headless chicken. Sometimes I get nice emails too. Nothing praising my amazingly scholarly stage presence or my diction. But nice emails nonetheless. Like the time in Boise when my microphone fell off its stand for the 20th time, and out of frustration I shouted, "Well, shit, fire and save matches," in front of 1,500 people. I got a sweet email from a woman who wrote, "It made me cry when you said that. I hadn't heard anyone say that since my granny died." Slowly but surely, I've let go of the images of me in Manhattan and started to embrace the real me. If I stand in the presence of my own mystery, I see a girl who was born in San Antonio, was educated at the University of Texas at Austin, was married at 100-year-old honky-tonk on Cibolo Creek, teaches at the University of Houston, gave birth to 2 children in the Texas Medical Center, is raising a family in Houston, plays in the Texas Hill Country, spends summers fishing in Galveston, and is having a lifelong love affair with this great state. But I also see the shadows that stretch over the hills and valleys of my life and this state. As I continue to dig into my Texas roots in an effort to integrate and become the one whole person I was meant to be, I learn something very powerful about the connection between my annihilation acumen and my upbringing. There's a reason our state motto is, "Don't mess with Texas." From the time we're old enough to stand, most girls raised in this state are taught the opposite of integration. We're raised to compartmentalize. We're raised to be tough and tender, but never at the same time. I was schooled on important matters like when to wear white shoes, how to set a table, and why upstanding families only use white meat in their chicken salad. But I was also taught how to spit, shoot a gun, and throw a Hail Mary pass on 3rd and 10. We're taught how to be tough and sweet. And, of equal importance, we're taught when to be tough and when to be sweet. And as we get older, the consequences of being tough and independent, when you're supposed to be tender and helpless, increase in severity. For young girls, the penalties range from a stern look to descriptions like tomboy or headstrong. But as we get older, the consequences for being too assertive or too independent take on a darker nature. Shame, ridicule, blame, and judgment. Most of us were too young and having too much fun to notice when we crossed the fine line into behavior not becoming of a lady. Actions that call for a painful penalty. Now, as a woman and a mother of both a daughter and a son, I can tell you exactly when it happens. It happens on the day girls start spitting farther, shooting better, and completing more passes than boys. When that day comes, we start to get the message in subtle and not so subtle ways that it's best that we start focusing on staying thin, minding our manners, and not being so smart or speaking out so much in class that we call attention to our intellect. This is a pivotal day for boys, too. This is the moment when they're introduced to the white horse. Emotional stoicism and self-control are rewarded. Displays of emotion are punished. Vulnerability is now weakness. Anger becomes an acceptable substitute for fear, which is forbidden. I don't think that there's any question that while also serving to keep existing power structures in place, the rules punish both men and women. And it's not just men who discourage integration and enforce the rules. It's the women, too. While there are many women fighting for a different way of life, there is still a powerful core group of sisters who have pledged their allegiance to a system where tough and tender are so driven apart from their natural coexistence that each one metastasizes into a dangerous version of itself. Tender turns into ass-kissing and people-pleasing. Tough turns into neck-wringing and bad-mouthing. These are the roles and behaviors that many of us were raised to adopt, even if they don't reflect who we are deep down inside. Gender politics is a lot like dancing. If you've ever seen a couple cutting a rug to a fast Texas polka, you get the picture. Gender itself is a combination of highly choreographed steps and well-rehearsed compromises. No matter who's calling the dance, it takes two to two-step. And while the music and the moves may differ by location or background, the underlying rhythms are pretty much the same. From Long Island to Silicon Valley, a fear of being perceived as weak forces men into pretending that they are never afraid, lonely, confused, vulnerable, or wrong. And an extreme fear of being perceived as cold-hearted, imperfect, high maintenance, or hostile forces women to pretend that they are never exhausted, ambitious, pissed off, or even hungry. Rumbling with nostalgia. Nostalgia sounds relatively harmless, even like something to indulge in with a modicum of comfort. until we examine the two Greek root words that form nostalgia. Nostos, meaning returning home, and algos, meaning pain. Romanticizing our history to relieve pain is seductive, but it's also dangerous. In fact, in the case of my own family, the seduction of nostalgia bordered on lethal. When you're raised by a wild pack of storytellers, the way I was, nostalgia is the currency of the realm. A certain poetry is assigned to those hard-living and fun-loving characters whose stories of mayhem and mischief were legendary in our family. No matter how many times we heard the tales, we loved them. And we loved knowing that a little outlaw blood coursed through our veins. But the truth cut right through the nostalgia of those stories one afternoon when I sat down to work on one of my last projects in my master's program, a family genogram. A genogram is a tool that behavioral health professionals use to visually map out a client's relationships and history. Genograms utilize complex symbols and lines to represent health histories and the social-emotional relationships between family members. I love maps, and I love relationships, so I gladly got out my paper, sharpened my colored pencils, and called my mom to talk with her about our family history. 2 hours later, I was staring at a map that could have been titled Hardscrabble, Texas, Population, Brené's Family. Looking at that map, I realized that much of what had been dressed up as hard living was really addiction and mental health issues. Yes, there were wonderful folkloric stories of struggle, triumph, and rebellion. But there was also story after story of trauma and loss. I remember one point in our conversation saying, "Jesus, Mom, this is scary. What the hell?" Her reply was, "I know. I lived a lot of it." I graduated 2 weeks later, on May 11th, 1996. I stopped drinking and smoking and went to my first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting on May 12th, 1996. I wasn't sure if I was an alcoholic, but I had been plenty wild in my teens and 20s, and I did not want to become a hard-living character in someone else's yarn or another casualty of addiction on someone's genogram. In The Gifts of Imperfection, I tell the story of not quite fitting in at AA and being told by my first sponsor that she thought I had the poo-poo platter of addictions. Not too much of any one thing, but enough of each one to be concerned. She suggested that it would be best if I covered all of my bases and just quit drinking, smoking, co-parenting my siblings, and comfort eating. I took her advice, and let's just say it freed up a lot of my time. I haven't had a drink or a cigarette in almost 20 years. I'm doing much better with the family stuff, and I'm taking the food, my real drug of choice, one day at a time, as they say. Over the past 2 decades, I've learned that what I really need is a Vulnerability Anonymous meeting, a gathering place for people who like to numb the feelings that come with not having control, swimming in uncertainty, or cringing from emotional exposure. When I wiped the nostalgia off my history to uncover the real trauma behind many of those stories, I began to understand why we didn't talk about emotions growing up. Of all the things trauma takes away from us, the worst is our willingness or even our ability to be vulnerable. There's a reclaiming that has to happen. Sometimes the deep love we feel for our parents or the sense of loyalty to our family often create a mythology that gets in the way of our efforts to look past nostalgia and toward truth. We don't want to betray anyone. We don't want to be the first to get curious and ask questions or challenge the stories. We ask ourselves, how can I love and protect my family if I'm rumbling with these hard truths? For me, The answer to that question is another question. How can I love and protect my family if I'm not rumbling with these hard truths? We know that genetics loads the gun and environment pulls the trigger. In order to teach our children about rising strong, we first need to teach them the truth about their history. I've told both my kids, look, drinking may not be the same for you as it is for your friends. Here's what you need to know and understand. I also don't frame my own wild stories as war stories from the good old days. Yes, I have wonderful family memories and stories of crazy adventures that I love to share. But when it comes to addiction, medical histories, and mental health, I believe that nostalgia is deadly. Stephanie Coons, author of The Way We Never Were, American Families in the Nostalgia Trap, puts her finger on some real dangers of nostalgia. She writes, "There's nothing wrong with celebrating the good things in our past, but memories, like witnesses, do not always tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. We need to cross-examine them, recognizing and accepting the inconsistencies and gaps in those that make us proud and happy, as well as those that cause us pain." Kuhn suggests that the best way to reality check our nostalgic ideas is to uncover and examine the trade-offs and contradictions that are often deeply buried in all of our memories. As an example, Coons writes, "I have interviewed many white people who have fond memories of their lives in the 1950s and early 1960s. The ones who never cross-examined those memories to get at the complexities were the ones most hostile to the civil rights and the women's movements, which they saw as destroying the harmonious world they remembered. But others could see that their own good experiences were in some ways dependent on unjust social arrangements or on bad experiences for others. Some white people recognized that their happy memories of childhood included a black housekeeper who was always available to them because she couldn't be available to her children." Coons is careful to point out that the people who rumbled with their nostalgia didn't feel guilt or shame about their good memories. Instead, their digging made them more adaptable to change. She concludes, "Both as individuals and as a society, we must learn to view the past in three dimensions before we can move into the fourth dimension of the future." There's a line in director Paolo Sorrentino's gorgeous haunting film, The Great Beauty, that illuminates the pain often underlying nostalgia. One of the main characters, a man reconciling his past while longing for love and relevance in his present life, asks, "What's wrong with feeling nostalgic? It's the only distraction left for those who have no faith in the future." Nostalgia can be a dangerous distraction, and it can underpin a feeling of resignation or hopelessness after a fall. In the Rising Strong process, looking back is done in the service of moving forward with an integrated and whole heart. Rumbling with criticism. To avoid criticism, say nothing, do nothing, be nothing. Aristotle. All criticism is not created equal and certainly doesn't have the same intention behind it.